Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere. Full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler, host of the BBC podcast The Global Story. Welcome to this bonus episode in the documentary feed. Since conflict broke out in Sudan in April last year, it's been almost impossible for journalists to get to the country and really find out what's happening. So we wanted to share this episode of The Global Story, where my colleague Lise Doucette hears from two BBC journalists about their incredible reporting from Sudan's forgotten war.
Today, rare access inside Sudan. It's almost 5 years since an image from Khartoum shot around the world. The woman in white. 22-year-old student Ala Salah stood on the roof of a car at dusk, surrounded by a sea of protesters filming her on their phones. She led the crowd in chants against the government. A picture of defiance, of shifting power, of hope. And today, the images from Sudan are a brutal, a tragic contrast. 11 months of war have ripped whole communities and lives apart. And the people of Sudan feel forgotten.
Some of the international communities, they are silent or they just condemn. But there is no intervention.
Thank you for joining us, but I should warn you, the stories my colleagues are about to share will include descriptions of violence and sexual abuse from inside Sudan and from many of the people who fled.
When they opened fire and we were lying on the ground, I remember praying. I was thinking that it was the end.
How did Sudan go from such great hope to such a grievous war? And why isn't the world paying more attention? Since the tensions between two ambitious military generals, between the army and a paramilitary force, exploded in April last year, it's been difficult and dangerous for international media to get into this country on the coast of Northeast Africa. I'm here, I'm happy to say, in our Global Story studio with Faris Kalani, our BBC Arabic special correspondent. I have to say he is very special.
Thank you.
Who's just returned from Sudan. Faris, I have to say, I'm relieved that you're here because I see you as one of our correspondents who finds a way, has the determination to go to the darkest, most dangerous corners. How are you?
Thank you for having me first. It's the only way to tell the story. We have to do it. I tried hard over the last few months to do it, and we managed to get the access at the end, and we have the story.
Well done. And I'm also happy to say we're joined from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, by Mercy Juma. What a great name and a great correspondent. BBC Africa correspondent, just returned from Chad on Sudan's border, where many Sudanese fled to escape the violence. Mercy, I have to say my ears prick up whenever I hear your voice on the BBC, and you brought us more of this extraordinary and, I have to say, very sad storytelling.
It's always a tough place to go back to. This is my second time to go back to Chad to tell the story about the people from Sudan. Heart-wrenching difficult conversations. But again, like Farah says, if we do not tell these stories, if we do not go to these places, then who will?
Let's put this into context. You may hear the acronym SAF. That's the Sudanese Armed Forces under General Burhan. He's Sudan's de facto leader since 2019. You may also hear RSF, Rapid Support Forces, and that is under a person whose nickname is Hemeti, a powerful and notorious, it has to be said, paramilitary group. Is that what it comes down to? Two deeply entrenched rivalries?
I think, yes, it is the situation. It's a struggle for power between the two men since the coup, which took place in October 2021.
They did it together and exactly, then they fell apart.
Exactly. And as you know, Hemeti, he has this fully supported militia called Rapid Support Force. It was created as a militia in the early 20s to fight against the non-Arab tribes in Darfur and got a lot of support from everywhere. He has the money, he has the power, he has good relations with some Arab countries, with Russia, with different players, even in Africa, in Chad itself. So it's not easy battle to remove him.
Two powerful men, believing they should be the one to rule Sudan, both of them, as we'll hear in this program, accused of war crimes. Faris, let's start with you, your recent trip. I know from having tried myself, it is almost sealed shut. They don't want the media to see what's happening. How did you do it?
I'll be honest, it's a friend. He was with me in my last trip to Sudan, where we were arrested by the military intelligence department at that time. I spent 12 hours in prison. Through this, I know one of the members, a general, one of the members of the Sovereignty Council, and he granted us the visa to go first to Port Sudan, just to the city on the Red Sea, you know. And from there, I managed to convince them to take me to the capital, which is not an easy part. It's the easiest part is to get the visa, by the way. To move on the ground, it's a nightmare.
It's very dangerous, right? Because kidnappings, attacks.
Everything you can imagine.
Complete chaos.
Yeah.
Well, I think our listeners will think, well, if I have to go to prison in order to get a visa for Sudan, I think I'll leave that one to Faris. You went to a city with a magical name, Omdurman, Sudan's second largest city, just across the River Nile from the capital, Khartoum, seen as a twin city. What did you see?
It's really sad to be there now. If you've been there, you know this very beautiful old market in the city, the covered one.
History of it.
Yeah, it's completely destroyed and looted. It's really sad to see it from there. The parliament on the edge of the river, it's looted and destroyed from inside. And the hospitals, there are two very important hospitals. Both were bombed badly by mortar, by fighter jets. It's unbelievable.
We moved to another place. Our operations department was hit. Our oxygen department was hit. Areas of the hospital that were vital for the patients. Despite these shells, we tried to stay, but the shelling was heavy and the wounded were arriving in large quantities.
The amount of destruction in Omdurman, the amount of looting there, it's almost in each house. And by what we told, the majority of it done by the RSF.
So most of that was done by the Rapid Support Force.
The looting, I'm talking.
The looting. But now it is in the hands of the government.
The majority of it.
Yes, or the army. The army.
Yeah, the army.
As they tear through these neighborhoods, of course, some people have fled, but some people are there. What did you hear from people who are still there?
When I was going around the streets, the only people I met there are the elderly, the old men or women. Because, hundreds...
can't leave or don't want
they
to
They can't leave. And one of them, he sent his kids away to Port Sudan and stayed there to protect his house. And it's really, really sad when you look at their faces. You see the amount of tiredness or the anger they have. They lived in this city for the whole of their lives and now it's destroyed and looted. And you hear the stories they witnessed firsthand. A man there, he saw them arresting girls, women, and taking them to flats or houses and raped them day after another after another.
They used to snatch women, take them inside the house and do anything with them. They didn't just want to take their pennies and beat them and throw them away. They shaved their heads bald and then they took pictures of them and sent them to their families. They filled people's cars and took the women with them. It's said that they went to brokers with them and sold young women from here.
Some say they took them to Darfur area. Others said that they took them outside the country even.
We saw theft and women and old men being beaten up. They threatened innocent girls. Money comes and goes, but attacking a woman's honour is not good. Now our situation is very difficult. We see that God gives victory to the Sudanese army, and we pray the militias never rule us again.
She said stabbing honour is something we cannot fix. We can't go back. They're beating them. They don't care whether they are in their 60s. She told them, I'm like your mother. I'm your mother's age. He said to her, you don't look like my mother. When you hear this thing, you just don't understand. Why would you do this against part of your people? It's unbelievable.
I can still see you're almost still trembling with sadness, yeah. And heartbreaking stories of violence, sexual violence. But also it's a deep humanitarian crisis. People don't have enough to eat. Stories of malnutrition. What did you see and hear?
Millions left their homes. There is a risk on the whole new generation, especially the kids.
We left our family behind. We were scattered. We can't find food. We can't find work. The children are looking for treatment. There's no food to eat. We're tired. I can't talk.
One of the clinics in Port Sudan, there was like 15 kids with their mothers. It took us back to the famine time decades ago in Sudan, if you remember the pictures. Mm. It's exactly the same. You can't believe you are in 2024 and after this revolution in 2019 and the hopes and you reach this point. Kids are almost dying because there's no food, there's no medicine.
The last pills I took were 10 days before the war. They finished 3 days before the war. I thought it would be over next week. But I never took another pill. From that moment on, I started to suffer. I mean, from April, right after the Eid, after the Ramadan. I have been in pain since.
There is no camps, despite there are 6 million displaced people inside Sudan. They live in the schools and anywhere they can find.
Mercy, you're listening, and I'm sure this is the kind of scenes you also see. But let's try to answer that question that Farah so painfully raised. How did Sudan get to that point? From that point we began with, that striking image of a young woman rallying Sudanese to rise up peacefully against their government for a different kind of future.
I am part of this revolution. I had no idea that my video would go viral. We were not scared, even though we were aware of all possibilities. We could have been shot dead. Anything could happen. I took part in the protest because I dreamt of a better Sudan, where everyone could live with dignity and honour.
Women were playing a defining role. Tell us about that time and what was it all about?
That period, 2018-2019, will always be, I would say, one of the most beautiful times that I have seen Sudan really starting up for themselves, you know. We're talking about an uprising or protest that was sparked by the rising cost of bread. It began as an economic protest and quickly just transitioned into a political and social protest as well. And what really stood out is the number of women who went to the streets, who did the sit-ins, channeling what people are today referring to as the image of the Nubian queens, the warrior Nubian queens. It was a beautiful sight to see the women coming up and standing for themselves.
They've made a contribution that is equal to that of the men in helping dislodge President Bashir from power. And they've made it clear that they won't be bowing out of public life now that he's gone.
Their firm refusal to conform to, you know, the imposed gender roles in how we conduct protests in Africa and in Sudan specifically. Mm. And there was a lot of hope that this could lead to Sudan seeing a period where it is no longer under autocratic rule and they will have a civilian government and the military will not be the center of everything they did. But unfortunately, this did not come to pass. Fast forward to 2021, and then we see this coup which ended in a transitional government put in place after the fall of Omar al-Bashir. And this is where now the RSF leader Hamdan Dagalo and the SAF leader Burhan that we have been talking about come in, because they worked alongside each other to help keep the military in power then when Bashir was ousted. The promise then was that in 2023 there would be an election and then transition to civilian rule. But that hasn't happened because these two people, these two army men, these two leaders disagreed over how these paramilitaries, the RSF, how will it be incorporated into the army.
So in short, to use your word, a beautiful, unprecedented moment which removed President Omar al-Bashir, who'd been a dictator for 30 years, also indicted by the International Criminal Court, a transition period where civil society and the military were supposed to work together, but didn't work. A joint coup by two powerful military generals. They fell out. And this is where Sudan finds itself today. In the midst of all this, then, how are the people of Darfur, one of the worst affected regions in a very badly affected country, coping with life displaced across the border in Chad?
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being. I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Paul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're hearing from some incredible women about what their countries are getting right.
And picking the best bits for our female fantasy land. Because you can't build it if you can't imagine it first. Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hallo, hier sind Julia und Chris vom Podcast Drinnies. Wir machen nicht nur einen Comedy-Podcast, sondern gehen auch leidenschaftlich gerne nicht zu Stoßzeiten in den Supermarkt. Ehrlich gesagt bleibe ich am liebsten ganz zu Hause und ziehe nur eine Hose an, wenn es klingelt. Wenn es euch auch so geht, dann ist HelloFresh genau das Richtige für euch. Der Kochbox-Lieferservice bringt euch frische, abwechslungsreiche Gerichte direkt vor die Haustür, die ihr im Handumdrehen selbst zubereiten könnt.
Und mit dem Code LECKER24 könnt ihr jetzt richtig sparen. In Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro, in Österreich bis zu 130 Euro und in der Schweiz bis zu 140 Franken. Also Code LECKER24 eingeben und sparen.
PS, der panierte Portobello-Pilz mit Sweet Chili Ketchup ist sehr gut.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
You're listening to The Global Story on the BBC World Service. Please do subscribe. It means you don't miss an episode. And do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. This conflict has shattered lives in Sudan. According to the UN, more than 6 million Sudanese have been forced to flee their homes and are internally displaced somewhere in the country. 1.5 million are said to have fled across the borders. The largest number, more than 500,000, have fled to Chad. And that's where you've just returned from, Mercy. One of your reports centers around the story of Ahmed. What was his story?
There had been video going around on social media showing, you know, people being lined up and killed, people being shot by the militia. In this video, Ahmed is standing with about 5 men, and then the person who's taking the video is speaking in Arabic. The person says, I'm just going to kill you now, and then he fires, like there's a lot of fire from an assault rifle, and all these people fall down. When we were talking to people in the refugee camps and asking them, hey, do you know where this happened? One of the people told us, actually, this person in this video has survived, is here.
I was hit in the shoulder. My body had other wounds and injuries. Three of us survived. We laid down as if we were dead. Then someone came and said, anyone who is injured better run away.
And when we showed Ahmed that video, he was so shocked. He cried because this was the first time seeing the video of him being shot at.
When they opened fire and we were lying on the ground, I remember praying. I was thinking that it was the end.
And he tells us he was shot at by a rapid support forces soldier. Unfortunately, the other people in that video, including one of Ahmed's friends and a cousin, died. He survived, but he showed me, you know, like the wounds he sustained and a really, really damaged spirit. And he carries a lot of trauma. A lot of trauma. Yeah.
We know it might not be today, tomorrow, this year, but one day justice will come.
Paint a picture for us of what it looks like in Chad. Faris mentioned that in Sudan itself, in the places he saw or heard about, there's no camps. People are going to schools wherever they can find shelter. Are there the tented cities that we often see in refugee crises along the border with Darfur?
Oh, there are thousands, thousands of tents. The first time I went to Adre, which is the border town in Chad, you know, the tents were coming up every day. This time when I went to Chad, about 5 months later since my first visit, the tents are still there. People are still constructing their houses. But one thing struck me. Driving through the refugee camps, I realized that the refugees now even have a graveyard. This is their home. They have even set a place aside to bury their dead. That tells you the sort of permanency that this is bringing to them. Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, have set up this inflatable, big inflatable tents. For me, as a motherless, one of the doctors tells me this is a 2-year-old and he weighs 6 kilograms. And you don't even know the kind of questions to ask this woman that you're supposed to interview. What do you tell them? What do you say to them? Because the horror is just too much to bear for me who is outside. You can imagine what it feels for somebody who's lived through these 20 years. And now, living through it again and really not knowing when it will all end.
Darfur has been threaded through our conversation today. And of course, the violence there goes back 2 decades, where there was what were called the Janjaweed militia at the time, and they later became the Rapid Support Forces. They were accused of carrying out ethnic cleansing, a genocide in the area. In that case, it was Arab militia against the non-Arab population. And now 2 decades on, it seems it's happening again. Is that how it looks to you, having been along the border?
Unfortunately, that's how it looks to me, and not just to me as a person who is looking at Darfur from the outside, but also to the people of Darfur. You know, like you said, after Khartoum, Darfur has seen the most violence since fighting broke out. We're talking about more than 600,000 people just fleeing into, you know, Chad alone. And, you know, one risk is that the conflict in Darfur has now evolved, and it's not what we're talking about, like 2 army generals and their supporters or 2 sides fighting each other. It has evolved into something that is ethnically based. So we are seeing fighting that is now between Arab versus non-Arab populations. The accusations and the allegations are always about the Rapid Support Forces and allied militia who are committing atrocities against the black communities who reside in Darfur.
And the women, Faris was telling us about the really distressing stories he heard, sexual violence and abuse. And it's such a contrast with that image of the powerful Alaa Salleh, who became an icon of the revolution in 2019. But Sudanese women know most of all that that's not the day-to-day reality now for most of Sudanese women, including those you met in Chad.
When we began speaking, we looked at the women as, you know, the face of the new Sudan that the people of Sudan envisioned. But in this current crisis, in this fighting, the women and the girls are bearing the biggest brunt of what is happening. Rape is being used as a weapon of war. when I met Amina, she was in a MSF facility. And the reason that she had gone to that facility is because she had missed her periods. You know, 18-year-old hijabi girl, Muslim girl, and it had been 2 months, and the doctors tell her that she's pregnant.
The incident happened in Sudan. I'm not married. I had never been with a man, except for the incident that happened. I didn't tell anyone. I don't think anyone knows. I just came to see a doctor because I didn't have my period for 2 months, and I have pain in my abdomen.
The first thing she tells the doctor is, do not tell anyone. I don't want anyone in my family to know this because I will be disowned. It is taboo. This is a lady who was captured when she was trying to flee Darfur to come to Chad. And her captors kept her for 2 days and they raped her through these 2 days. This was the first time she had ever been with a man. And now she's carrying a pregnancy. Amina decided not to keep the pregnancy, so the last I saw of her is when she was given these pills to go and take them somewhere in her heart in the refugee camp, and she will go through an abortion. But Liz, Amina is going through this alone because she cannot tell anyone. She cannot tell her sister who she fled with. She cannot tell her mother who she fled with because they will disown her.
Did they have the energy, the presence of mind to tell you why they think this is happening, including the weaponizing of rape?
Most of the girls and women that I spoke to say they feel that the women and girls of Sudan are being raped by the militia and the armed men because they know what doing this does to their dignity, and not just for them, but also the males in their family, because they make some of them look, or rather watch, as they are sexually abused. But others feel that this all comes down to the long-standing tensions, the long-standing feuds between the blacks and the non-blacks, or the black and the Arab communities in Darfur.
This is revenge, because the Arab militias targeted a particular group, the Masalit, because of a history of old problems. They are doing this to the women because rape leaves an impact on society and the family. They use it as a weapon of revenge.
Well, this episode of The Global Story is one of harrowing accounts. I hope you're staying with us, because this is a story which matters, and it's a story of two rival warlords, their feuding armies, their powerful foreign backers. It's about the people of Sudan who are suffering enormously. There's so many very deep, dark crises around the world now, and some are getting more attention than others. Gaza, Ukraine, Haiti. When you were in Sudan, what did you hear from Sudanese? Do they feel they've been forgotten?
You hear this everywhere you go, and they know that for a fact, especially with what's going on in Gaza. They themselves, even in some cities like Port Sudan, because it's still safe there, they spend hours watching the news in Gaza. So I think, yes, it's accurate to say that they feel this way, they were forgotten.
And Faris, I can feel it when I first met you here in the studio. I hadn't seen you for a while. You're still feeling the pain of your visit.
Yeah, but it's our duty to keep fighting to get the access and to try to tell the story. But sadly to say, I don't know what happened to this world, but over the last 10 years, the media is not being a strong factor. It lost its purpose.
It's maybe, too, that the forces pushing for war are stronger than the forces pushing for peace.
Maybe, yeah, but it doesn't mean by any meaning that we should stop.
This is our time, and this is why we have podcasts like The Global Story, to remind ourselves, to remind you, our listeners, that in our time and on our watch, a major African country is being ripped apart. A major humanitarian crisis, massive displacement, allegations of war crimes, genocide. Faris Kalani, special correspondent for the BBC Arabic Service, we're so grateful that you came in to share what you had seen and heard yourself on the ground.
Goodbye. Thank you so much, Liz.
Mercy Juma, BBC Africa correspondent. Thank you, too, for sharing all your stories, as hard as they were to hear and to tell. Thank you very much.
Goodbye. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you to you, all of our listeners, to being with us yet again as we try to convey the importance and how to understand a global story.
Thank you for listening to this bonus episode of The Global Story in the documentary feed. If you like this and you want to hear more of our episodes, search for The Global Story, subscribe, and don't forget to leave us a review wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Ob zum Meditieren, Entspannen oder Einschlafen, der neue Podcast Weltwach Klangreise geleitet dich in einem einzigartigen Hörerlebnis rund um den Globus. Begleitet von echten Aufnahmen von vor Ort, bereist du in deiner Fantasie ganze Kontinente, erlebst Klang für Klang ihre vielfältige Flora und Fauna und hörst entspannende Geschichten, die dir erlauben, dich inmitten dieser Umgebungen zu wähnen. Weltwach Klangreise, jetzt abonnieren.